This is On The Record. I'm Bharati Jagdish. Award-winning architect Liu Thai Ker created controversy a few years ago when he said that Singapore needs to plan for a population of 10 million. At a time when Singapore was facing overcrowding because of the influx of immigrants, many scoffed when he made that statement. Today, he stands by it, saying it's not too late to start planning for a larger population now. Liu is the eldest son of artist Liu Kang and planned to follow in his father's footsteps, but circumstances railroaded his plans and he ended up studying architecture instead. He doesn't regret it one bit. His career has seen him greatly influence Singapore's urban landscape as CEO of the Housing and Development Board between 1979 and 1989 and as CEO and Chief Planner of the Urban Redevelopment Authority. He's also noted for being a proponent of heritage and nature conservation. Today, he is the founding chairman of the Center for Livable Cities and senior director of RSP Architects, leading master planning and urban design efforts in more than 30 cities. He went on the record with me about why his plan for a larger population won't compromise livability, what he regrets the most about his career, and why Singapore needs more intellectual thinkers. We first talked about the factors that have influenced him the most over the years.
I grew up in the British colony. At that time, we didn't have nationality. I was just a British subject. And later, during the Japanese occupation, I just felt if you don't have a strong country, you cannot really have your own dignity and have a good life. These two factors influenced me greatly. And later, when my mother succeeded in persuading me to become an architect, I thought, fine, I would, because in those days in Singapore, three out of four people in the 50s and until 60s, three out of four people lived in squatters. So I thought, being an architect, maybe I'll grow up and help people build houses. But then, to be a good architect, I need to know planning. So from Australia, I went to Yale to study city planning. So all of these were designed to prepare myself to be ready to come back to Singapore to contribute to the building of the nation.
You grew up in a kampung, I understand.
In Mua. I lived in initially in my grandparents' house, which is on the outskirts of Mua. So it's like a kampung-type environment, lots of vegetables and chickens and pigs and so on.
Mm. How did living in that environment influence your work or you? Your thinking at all?
Well, certainly, comparing the kampung life with the urban life, which I got acquainted to in Singapore, with toilet, clean water supply, and so on. Of course, I wanted to be able to create the environment with that kind of facilities. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, by having lived in kampung and being close to animals, mud, vegetation, and so on, I also develop a feeling for nature, and that also has influenced my work later in life. In the 50s, when the British is still our colonial master, we just had either urban slum or squatters, and the environment was not very clean. For example, Singapore River and the river along the New Bridge Road. You know you're there with your eyes closed because you smell the stench of the pollution. And also the buildings were old and dilapidated and people were poor. My parents, despite the fact that they were school teachers, they were desperately poor. And I had to live in an environment that really would be considered by today's standard extremely poor people. So those were kind of motivation for me to try to do something to change my life.
You wanted to change your life, but you once said that you wished you had worked to preserve a small part of the squatter areas. Did you yourself ever experience that type of life?
I was a little bit better off than that. But when I was in HDB, I used to visit squatter colonies. For example, one day after the rain, I asked my HDB colleagues to walk with me on Red Hill, which is now called Red Hill Estate. It was just Squatter Colony. And as it was, we were walking on a mud road, and rainwater was still flowing down the sloping road. And together with that was human feces and pig feces and rubbish and so on. And so that kind of environment, I feel that it's hard. If you don't see the actual environment, it's very hard for younger generation Singaporeans to understand what kind of environment it was. So one of my regrets is that if I could, you know, at that time, save, say, 1 or 2 or 3 hectares of land, which is not a lot compared with the size of Singapore, save the 1 or 2 or 3 hectares of squatter areas, keeping them exactly as they were. True. So the power of convincing the younger generation by photographs, by words, would not be as strong as if you see the real thing. Mm-hmm. It's only something I thought about recently. Mm. Today's Singaporeans, not only they have all this modern facility, they also have other amenities like schools and sports fields and so on. So I feel that to give them a chance to see the past and today, to have a comparison, they will be more appreciative of what they have and maybe even also more appreciative of what the government has done for them. And by being more appreciative, hopefully, on the one hand, their attitude will be more positive towards the society. On the other hand, they would also be spurred to say, okay, if the earlier generation could make such a big changes, and why can't we also carry on improving life, spurring them to do the solid changes. If Singaporeans could be more appreciative of what they already own, they may become, first of all, happier people, so that they would not just complain at the drop of hat. And if there's something not right, instead of just complaining, maybe try to do something. Complaint doesn't change your life, I think. But by noticing the imperfection and try to do something, it would be more useful.
You mentioned earlier that your mother had to persuade you to be an architect, and she successfully did so. And this has been talked about a lot whenever your name comes up, that you actually wanted to be an artist like your dad, but then your mother persuaded you otherwise. What exactly did she say to persuade you?
I finished high school at the age of 16. At age 17, I was thinking about my future because my parents absolutely had no money to send me to university. Then somebody asked me to be a substitute teacher at age 17 in a primary school. So I did that. Some of my students in my class were like 19, 20 years old, older than me. And they were 19, 20 older than me because they were affected by the Japanese occupation. There were many years that they could not go to school. Anyway, through that few years of teaching, I accumulated some money. So I thought that since my parents had totally no capability to send me to university, despite the fact that I had very good school results, then why don't I just use the money to buy a passage to China? In those days, We didn't have nationality. I didn't have a country, so China is the nearest thing for me to choose, to go to China and then to enroll in an art school. So I announced that to my parents. I said, look, in 2 weeks' time, I'll be gone. And of course, my mother howled her eyes out and then said, don't do anything. Let me think of something else. And remarkably, 2 days later, she found a solution. One is to persuade me to do architecture so that by being an architect, I could lift the family from poverty into a better life. And two is that at that time, University of New South Wales had part-time courses. So that means I could work and study at the same time. That would make this journey more affordable for the family. So I thought, why not? In my mind at that time, frankly, I was thinking that, okay, I'll do something for to make my mother happy. But after finishing university, I would go back to art. And because of that thinking, when I went to Sydney, University of New South Wales, I enrolled in art school to take art classes half a day every week.
What kind of art are we talking about?
I did life drawing, oil painting, watercolor painting, and even make friends with some famous artists in Sydney and famous art critics. Even though at my very young age, they became my friends. But by the time I finished year four, it was a six-year part-time course. By the time I finished year four, I realized that being an architect was more useful to help pulling Singapore out of its condition, a kind of backward condition. So at that point, I decided to just spend my energy full-time on architecture.
Did you ever regret this decision? Have you, since you made it?
No. In fact, I just can't believe that I'm such a lucky person that I could come back to Singapore and work in HDB, work in URA, and do the things that I wanted to do as a young boy. Yeah.
I know you said that you saw architecture at that point as a useful contribution relative to what Singapore needed at the time. But wouldn't you say the arts would have been a useful contribution too?
I think changing the person's physical condition, physical environment, to me, was a more immediate mission. But actually, while you are doing the changes to a person's physical environment or city's physical environment, it doesn't preclude you from doing art. In fact, if we have better housing, we have more convenient schools and so on, you are actually giving the people better chance to be educated, and therefore they can pursue their intellectual or cultural activities. So physical environment is a catalyst for culture as well. What I just said was a concept, a vision, a theory. You could create better environment, provide better facilities. It helps intellectual and artistic development and economic development for sure. But in the early days in Singapore, because of our utter poverty, the Singapore government gave priority to the improvement of physical environment, and the cultural development came later.
I ask you this because for a time you were also chairman of the National Arts Council. Some artists feel that even then, art should not have been an afterthought in Singapore. In fact, sometimes the best art emerges from strife and poverty as someone with the instinct to be an artist. Why don't you see it that way?
Yes, I personally feel that there's a tendency among Singaporeans that we lead whatever we call a life, and then cultural activity is like an additional activity. That means when you are free, then you go into it. I don't think that's a good idea, because I feel that I totally agree that in a lot of the ancient countries, art and living are totally integrated. Here, they are kind of, there's a line drawn between living and art. And I wish that this can be integrated. But I'm not totally depressed by that, because I feel that there are many cultural organizations here which are doing the best, particularly those NGOs, to try to integrate art more into living. And I just hope that they will continue to be successful and then help people facilitate this kind of dream. Perhaps one additional wish I have is that if we could start this kind of concept, not so much start, but to reinforce this kind of concept in schools. In other words, try to integrate art education as part of living, rather than something that's additional. I think that would go a long way towards cultural development. Because at the moment, cultural development is almost like, tends to be like a kind of entertainment It's not. It's really an expression of living art, living a life. But in addition to art, I personally also feel that Singapore, if we were to stay on the forefront of nations, we not only have to look at further development art, but also further development of intellectual thinking. I think we tend to be a little bit too pragmatic. Pragmatic towards art and pragmatic towards intellectual thinking, because it's only through intellectual thinking then we can think deeper into a problem. And by thinking deeper into a problem, then we have invention. If we think just superficially, we will not be able to see things that other people can't see.
What makes you think we lack this in today's Singapore?
Well, when I move around, because my job takes me out of Singapore quite a bit, and I feel that if a job needs 100% to be done, a shallow person will get it done till 80% and consider the job done. And I do find quite a number of that among Singaporeans. But I find from other countries, people, when I give them a job which requires 100% effort, and after a while I ask them, I said, "Where's your work?" And he and she would say, "Oh, not yet, I'm still working." Mm. By the time they come back and bring back the job to me, I take a look, and it's 100% done. Now, when you do that, you're making progress. You're making headways where other people don't make. And I feel that it is something I do worry. Ours is basically a pragmatic society. So if you get the job done 80% and you feel that you can get by, your customers or your boss feel that, well, you can consider the job done, well, why not? But when you do that, you would not go into the areas where other people have not thought of. Now, that is, to me, is an innovative society. We need more people thinking like that.
Why do you think we've become like this?
I think that we have been, out of necessity, in the last 50-odd years, we have been very pragmatic, which is a virtue. When I say that I wish people could be more intellectually deep thinking, more culture, it doesn't mean that we should abandon pragmatism. I think we should have everything. Pragmatism, deeper intellectual thinking power, and appreciation of culture. We need all that.
How do you think we can develop this ability to be intellectual thinkers?
Well, I'm not an expert in this, but I feel that it has to start in school education, because a person, as we all know, a person's habit of thinking is formed during the first 5 years or maximum 12 years of a life. So if we can start young, then I think it would be easier. I feel that we could ask more searching questions. You know, when there's a problem, we should not just stop at finding a solution. We should ask ourselves, well, if now this is a solution, but is there a way to do a better job than this? Just ask certain questions. And also maybe we need to have a greater emphasis on studying history and philosophy. Through studying philosophy and history, you actually probe deeper into the intellectual depth. Maybe I would like to say one more thing. Once I was talking to an education expert from Scandinavia, I said, "Why is art education important?" He said, "Because it helps you imagine things." And he said, "But imagining things is not just from art education. It's when you teach a student science subject or other subject, you must take them through the class, not just by explaining what is in the textbook, but go beyond that for them to think deeper into the subject." So I said, if that's the case, then can we just do without art education if the subjects are properly taught? Oh, no, he said. Art education is very different from the other subject because other subjects have boundaries. Art education has no boundary. Mm. You have to keep probing deeper and deeper and deeper. So here, it gave me an idea, and that is when we have art education, don't treat it as skill training that you can play the piano well or you can draw an apple nicely, but treat it as an exercise in probing deeper and deeper into the unknown. And I think that can be very helpful. Mm. So it's an issue of what is our definition of the purpose of art education. Of course, technical training is important, but on top of that, I think we use it as a medium to develop a person's mind.
Even today, though, there are still issues of censorship and disagreement over state funding. If we have so many out-of-bounds markers in Singapore, can we truly have a vibrant arts education that encourages probing without boundaries in Singapore?
Personally, I feel that a society needs to have OB markers because otherwise there will be a lot of conflicts.
But that's an assumption we make. Talking about difficult issues could also bring enlightenment.
Yes.
And understanding.
Yes, but personally, I feel that we certainly should talk about difficult issues, but not in an irresponsible way. In other words, you don't talk about something different or difficult for the sake of being different and difficult. You must have a basis for saying that. You must build up your argument for doing so. Now, that requires intellectual depth. So personally, I feel that I'm a little bit concerned that it's now a fashion that if you talk about something that people have not said irresponsibly, then you become very clever and people clap for you. That to me is not healthy. If you want to be different, you have to have a new ideas. You have to build up a strong argument for it. That to me is a real intellectual depth.
You yourself created controversy a few years ago when you said that Singapore's planners should plan for a population of 10 million. Some say you made a good case for it. Others asked why you would even suggest having so many people populate this tight space.
Singapore, unlike other countries, if you don't plan long term, if you don't conserve your land carefully, when you run out of land, you have no land to expand. This is a very peculiar problem of Singapore. So on the one hand, you want Singapore to be a country forever. On the other hand, you have limited land. On the other hand, you also have fast-growing population size. So what's the reason for us not to plan long-term for large number just to make sure we can be self-sufficient?
Now, you, of course, were not saying that we should have 10 million people. You were just saying that we should plan for it. Should it happen, we will then be prepared. You were in charge, though, between 1989 and 1992. You were CEO and chief planner of the Urban Redevelopment Authority. Why didn't you think that way then? Why didn't you plan for a larger population? We could have avoided many of the overcrowding problems that we've been facing for several years now.
That was in between 1989 and 1992. At that time, I was already that worried that Singapore, if we did not plan well enough, we will run out of land. Now, unlike other countries, if other countries ran out of land, they just go into the rural area. If we run out of land, we will hit the international line and we can't build anymore.
But clearly you didn't plan for this either when you were in charge.
Until today, most planning would planning horizon of about 15 to 20 years. So I felt that we had to plan for long term. So we adopted X year concept. We plan for X year. It was a term used by me. Why X year? It's because if I told the society in those days I wanted to plan for 100 years, I think I would be told off. Maybe I would even lose my job because nobody did that. So I decided to just use year X. It was meant for 100 years. Then we proceeded to check, also ask some experts, in 100 years, what would be the number of population in Singapore? At that time, in 91, we had 3.2 million. And our economy was just starting to grow faster. So very few of them projected beyond 4.5 million. That means by 2091, based on the projection at that time, we will have 5.5 million people.
That was a gross underestimation.
So by 2017, we already have 5.7 million. Did I make a mistake? Yes. But at least I jack up the number beyond other people's projection. And second, despite the fact this was under-projecting, but I, being a very good Singaporean, I have the virtue of being a kiasu man. So despite that 100-year projection, I still kept a lot of land undeveloped. Not only that, I even negotiated with PSA for the ultimate boundary of land reclamation. Some of this is still not reclaimed, but it's in the plan.
There's room for more to be reclaimed.
Oh, room for more.
It's just that the numbers you were given were not quite accurate.
It was not accurate, but I want you to name me one urban plan anywhere in the world where the population projection is accurate.
That's the problem, right? I mean, you never know what's going to happen, how many more people you're going to need to keep your economy growing.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at 10 million?
First of all, I learned the lesson. The projection for year X is under-projected. Second, I also learned a second lesson. Because Singapore population grew faster than we could even envisage in 1991. Why? Because if your economy is growing well, no government with any amount of power can stop the population growth. Unless you tell the city to say, look, I don't want economic growth, then you can stop the population growth. Which government would want to do that? Now, concrete example, like Beijing, Shanghai. In China, they have the Hukou system. You know, you register at different districts. Despite that system, Shanghai cannot and Beijing cannot stop the population growth to now it's like 24, 25, 26 million. These are the lessons we learn. You know, since our government is doing a good job in economic growth, we create a lot of jobs. We need not only people to fill up the job, but even talented people. So we just have to accept population growth.
But like you said, you can't really project it accurately and you can't stop it. So why 10 million then? I mean, why not go up to 20 million?
Yes, because I also read somewhere there's a UN report that by 2075, the world can no longer support any more population. In other words, between now and 2075, the world population may double. By then, the world's resources can no longer support any more population. So if we plan to 2075, I think this is almost like the ultimate number. But even if we plan this, I personally would still want to reserve some land just in case a UN prediction is not right.
You said we can plan for 10 million and accommodate 10 million people without losing green spaces and heritage and conservation areas and buildings. How exactly?
Having been a chief planner before, I know Singapore's land situation quite well. And I feel that despite the 10 million, there will be enough land, including the future reclaimed land, that would accommodate that. And at the same time, we should keep all the existing parks, golf courses, historical area, bungalows and so on, because we need all of this for us to be a complete city.
And so you're saying it's possible to keep all of these areas?
It is possible.
While housing 10 million people?
Yes.
But would this mean taller blocks, denser towns and
taller,
things like that?
Yes. But if we,
why didn't we build taller blocks right from the start?
Because at that time, we didn't expect the population to grow so fast, so big. Okay, we didn't expect Singapore economy to be so successful. But if we plan for taller and more dense development now. If we decide now, today, that means we can distribute the taller buildings more evenly across our island. And therefore, you don't see big bunches of tall buildings in certain areas, because if you do so, that becomes a slum area. So if we do it now, we have better choice of creating environment where you have a kind of a mixture of different densities. For example, people not only accept it, but even love the Pinnacle. Okay, why? Because Pinnacle stands alone among the shop houses. Now, if you put 20 Pinnacles next to each other, would you still love Pinnacle? Okay, I want to avoid that situation.
Mm.
If we plan now,
it'll all be the same. Yeah.
If we plan now, we can take better charge of that density distribution, so that you don't put all the high density in one go. You separate them. And actually, the definition of high density is to create a physical environment where it's very difficult to see the sky. But if you mix them around this way, it's still possible to see the sky.
But how livable will it really be? I mean, transport nodes have experienced overcrowding already. We've seen more MRT lines open up. But clearly, at one stage, the city wasn't ready to accommodate the population comfortably because of the influx of immigrants. What about transport?
Singapore was planned as a transit-oriented city. That means we wanted the city to be able to carry people mainly by MRT and buses. But at that time, we did not have a clear concept of how many people we would like to travel by public transport, how many percent of people would like to travel by public transportation. I'm happy to say that the government in the recent years has added quite a few MRT lines. But I just hope that they have done a calculation to say that given this kind of additional MRT lines, would the train and the station be able to cope with the amount of travelers? If they have done the calculation, then maybe the problem will be solved in due course. If they have not done, maybe they need to do that to see how many more train lines we need.
So of course, there are more breakdowns as well and disruptions.
No, that's a separate thing. One is to plan for the need. Actually, to have our MRT service and the bus, the two must be combined, done well.
Mm.
We need several factors. One is to do the prediction of the, not only to set the target of how many percent people will want to travel by public transportation. Two is to plan according to such target. And three is to plan them and develop them in good time. So I think currently the development is slightly behind time. So it's a management issue. So I think I personally remain reasonably optimistic that when these new lines are done, probably the situation will be better, assuming that they've done their calculation. And four is the maintenance. There are four factors. Maintenance is quite obvious that it's not as good as one had wished. You have to decide how many percent of people travel by MRT. Two is where to put the line. Apart from these two, the others are management issues. So when we talk about problems, we have to be very clear in what context we're talking about. It's a management issue. Now, my pushing for 10 million is to start thinking now so that we can minimize, well, we have to go for higher tenants, but hopefully not too high, because now we have more land available for us to play around with the density.
Why do you think our government planners today are not doing that?
No idea.
Mm.
Because once I leave the government, I don't really have a communication channel with the government. Well, I hope that they will take the 10 million seriously and really try to study a plan for that.
You've mentioned the importance of preserving heritage and nature areas and even golf courses while being able to house a population of 10 million. But already today, about half that population, we've seen several nature and heritage areas go or be in danger of going. The loss of Bukit Round caused quite a furore, and there's been debate over the impact of the cross-island MRT line being built beneath the Central Catchment Nature Reserve. Have the planners so far just not been using land efficiently enough, resulting in these places being impacted?
Nothing is absolute, because even during my time, it was already made known that Bukit Brown would be gone. So Bidadari would be used up. And of course, if I cannot guarantee that the current 28 golf courses would be kept as 28, maybe less. But I'm saying that, you see, there's a Chinese saying that a sparrow may be small, but it has all the organs of a bigger animal. In Singapore, we're not just a city, we're a country. We must have all the facilities of a country or even a city. So we need nature, we need heritage, we need golf courses, we need military land and so on. We must keep those. Now, in order
why do we need golf courses, though? I mean, what's so essential about them? They're just leisure.
Well, leisure is part of living. And also, it's good for businessmen as well. If it's good for businessmen, it's good for economy. So if other countries have golf courses, why shouldn't we do that? I'm not in communication with the planners, but if I look at the map of Singapore, we do have spaces. We still have land not reclaimed. Now, if the planner says that we have very little land, we can go for 10 million, I would say then it's even more critical we plan for 10 million now, if what they say is correct. Because if we plan for 15 years, or maybe you add another 10, 20 years, we use up all the land, but then population continue to grow, because economy is still booming. We said, no more land. Mm. So we stop economic growth. Is that a good idea?
Or we'll have to deal with more people and be very, very uncomfortable.
I didn't mention that you could also redevelop some of the industrial area, because a lot of the industrial area in the early days were single-story terrace factories. Mm. Now, you can actually intensify, because nowadays JTC also has developed multi-story industrial areas. So we can also hopefully use some of the land for housing, for commerce, and so on.
So we don't need to lose more heritage and nature areas?
I don't want heritage to lose, because if Singapore were to be a world-class city, you need to have heritage, you need to have culture, you need to have beautiful natural environment, you need to have golf courses. If we don't have all these things, we cease to be a world-class city.
I'm sure you're aware of how we've lost some of these spaces over the years, and the debate over the Central Catchment Nature Reserve and MRT line being built around it or beneath it, and how building beneath it might endanger the flora and the fauna there. Where do you stand on such issues?
I've left the government. I don't want to get drawn into the controversy. But since you ask, I would say this. MRT line investment is expensive. So if the same line can go through more urban area, picking up more passengers, first of all, you get a better return for your investment. And second, you serve more people than if you had gone through the MacRitchie, the underground. You have a long stretch of MRT line without income and nor serving more people.
Mm. But you save some money by not building a longer line.
I would say,
was their argument, and you save some time.
You save some time for the people on the line, but you cause more people not being able to take the MRT lines. So I think the sum total of it is quite different. Okay, I think we should look at the bigger good.
How do you feel about Bukit Brown?
In urban planning, you have to make a choice. You have to make a choice of between heritage, nature, rivers, and cemetery. Personally, I feel that cemetery, your priority should be for the living rather than for the dead.
And what about Rocho Center?
I believe the government probably has done an economic study. It's public housing, but at a place with very high land premium. By tearing down and redevelop for something of higher value, to me, it makes economic sense.
While being a proponent of nature and heritage, you also seem to take what some would describe as an unsentimental economic approach to the issues. How do you personally strike that balance?
You have to think of all of them at the same time. Mm. You have to. And of course, for different issues, certain factors may take higher priority than the others.
Are there any places or buildings that you feel we could have avoided losing had the planners done a better job of using land more efficiently?
Off the cuff, I can't think of anything that's that is a serious loss. No, off the cuff.
Mm-hmm. What would be a serious thing to lose in the future?
I would say a serious thing to lose would be things which are valuable to us but irreplaceable.
Mm. Such as, to you personally?
Nature, historical buildings. But I would say it's not just things to lose, but also things that we should do and we don't do. And I think the most serious thing to my mind is to really look seriously on the 10 million population.
Mm.
Because in my view, a planner's job is to solve the very difficult problem as early as possible. It's just like a person, if he is rather unwell and he feels that it's impossible for him to get a doctor, then when he gets really much more sick, it will cost him more money to get medical attention. A city now, yes, to move our population size from 5.7 million to 10 million, it's not easy, but if we do it now, it's easier than if we leave it till later when we have to do it. So I personally feel that the more difficult the problems, the easier we have to handle.
Architect and master planner Liu Tai Ker, thanks for joining us on The Record.